Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here, and I think we can have a little conversation. What I'd like to do is make it more intimate and get into some of your questions as well, some of your comments. Usually when I try to speak, I like to look at it like a town hall meeting just to have people talking about issues again and talking about issues that of some relevance, but also issues of how we actually can get things done. I wrote Hearts and Hands. This is like my latest book, and it came out paperback this year, kind of summarizing 20 years or more of working with kids who are in gangs, in juvenile facilities, prisoners, troubled kids, not so much in gangs, but, you know, kids who are kids, young people, youth, high school kids. And I thought I needed to summarize it because there's a lot of things that we learned, a lot of lessons, a lot of heartbreaking things. Because for anybody who works with young people, you have to expect to have your heart broken. You have to know that it's going to take a toll. Sometimes you work real good with these young people, and they end up doing very well, and you see them really growing, and then you get that phone call that they've just been shot. Or, you know, they've just been arrested, and they're going to serve a long time. And it is very hard for people to do this kind of work. I understand why a lot of people don't. But I don't think what I really understand is why a lot of people decide not to relate to youth again. And especially the way that I see what's happening in a lot of our communities, where a lot of people become very scared of young people again. We forget what it was when we were young. We forget our own hungers and our own angers. We forget how important it is for young people to be angry, but also to be in trouble. I mean, part of my thing is to point out to people that trouble is so natural to human life and human development, but in our culture, we don't want no trouble. We have a zero tolerance. We have a way that we just don't want to look at it. If somebody's troubled, we want to get them out of our faces. We don't got the patience, the time, or even the love, even though I know the love is there to do that. I know that, for example, a lot of teachers, and I know there's some teachers here, and people, counselors, and people work with youth, one of the biggest things they tell you is you got to be professional, which means you got to have a distance between you and the young people. Now, I'm not saying that there's not a point to that. There actually is a good point to have a certain amount of distance, but I think the distance comes from being older and knowledgeable. You know what I mean? But I think what I would like to see is breaking down that emotional disconnection that people have. Having the distance should not mean that I can't have an emotional tie to these young people. And almost like these young people are looking for adults, for mentors, for teachers to look to and say, show me the ropes, show me something. I'm entering life, and I don't have any way to understand where to go. And very few people want to make those connections, so therefore they hardly have any real mentors and guides into their future. And I think this is what one of the problems of having a culture that says there should be this distance, no emotional connection. In the work that we did in Chicago, for example, I grew up in L.A., and I've come back to L.A. about 3 years now. We've been back. But I spent 15 years in Chicago, and for the last 10 years of that, I did a lot of work with young people. We created a group called Youth Struggling for Survival, and it was really an outcome of Always Running. So many people know about my book, Always Running. When the book came out, I guess it was a matter of not just talking the talk, but then walking the walk. What are you going to do with these kids? And my first big test was my son, Ramiro, because at 15 years old, he joined a gang in Chicago. And I needed to then address my own issue as a father, but also as a member of the community, and what could I do for kids like Ramiro, as well as people around him. And it turns out that we started this group to help his homies, to help his small little gang that he was part of, but actually was very intensely involved. That gang was attacked by everybody. They were being used to do wars against different gangs, and they were paying a big price. And what we would do is have them come together. At my house, they would meet. We would meet at different people's homes. We started doing what's called peace retreats, taking them to the forest preserves in Chicago. There's these beautiful forest preserves. And we would take them there just so they can get out of the city and get into their lives. It wasn't easy, and I'll tell you what I mean. The first time, we took a group of 25 kids, and we hooked up with the Puerto Rican kids in Humboldt Park as well as the Mexican kids in Pilsen. Those were the two main barrios, Puerto Rican and Mexican, even though the Mexican community is much larger, and really half of the Puerto Rican community is Mexican, we did do a lot of work with the Puerto Rican Mexican community. And so we invited like 25 of these mostly gang kids to these peace retreats. We took them to a forest preserve, and this was the first one I went to. And I will tell you, it was a, talk about taking its toll. The first night, there was a 15-year-old girl that in one of the tents was selling herself for $5. One of the guys brought a whole mess of crack. About three or four people ran off. We couldn't find them. They came back, and then the rangers came by because they actually had ripped off some people's car, broken somebody's car. I mean, this is like, you know, the first night was like, man, I don't know if we can do it. But what we did is two or three of the adults lost it, didn't know what to do. And I said, we're going to pull all the youth together, and we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about what we came here for. We're going to talk about what we want to get out of this. We're going to talk about what we're going to tolerate and what we're not going to tolerate. And we sat down with everybody, and we talked, just the issues, why they had no respect for what we were doing. And it all made sense. Everything they did made sense. Because one thing about young people is, believe it or not, even though it may not seem like it, there's nothing senseless about what they do. You know, it might seem like it isn't, but if you look at the root, there's a real good basis for why they do what they do. Sometimes the basis is at home. They get abused a lot. They don't get any respect at home or in the schools. And then you see them acting out the same way that they've been taught their whole lives. There's a lot of another roots for everything. So by the very end of that meeting gathering, this is like the morning after everybody had done all this craziness, then we asked the kids, whoever wanted to leave, I would personally drive them all the way back to Chicago. That nobody had to stay here. But if they were going to stay, they were going to learn something. And they were going to give something. And I think we only had maybe, I think one or two kids actually wanted to leave. And I did. I drove them back. By the way, those two kids that left ended up becoming very active in the group later on. But for that moment, I gave them that respect. You don't want to be here? You don't have to be here. I'll drive you back. In the meantime, the kids that stayed, they made a little commitment that they would behave themselves, quote unquote, but they would also learn and be part of the group. And we extended this over the years where we started having peace retreats on a regular basis. I want to tell you another one. By then, we started doing sweat lodge ceremonies. How many are familiar with indigenous Native American sweat lodge ceremonies? Well, most people, which is really good. We started to connect with some of the Native American groupings there, but also the Mexican and Guatemalan indigenous people that were there. And we had one Mayan guy from Guatemala who was a sun dancer in the Lakota Pine Ridge Reservation and had been doing it for several years. And so he could relate to the Latino kids, but he was also very much trained in the Lakota Native American tradition. So he did the first sweat lodge. And we had 75 young people come together for this first time. And not only that, we had rival gang kids. We didn't even know this. One kid had actually been shot by another kid that showed up. So in the beginning, it was the same tension. They were mad-dogging each other. We didn't know whether we were going to make it. The people might have been killed. You know, anything could have happened. But we kept hanging in there. We kept talking to these kids. We had to have a big circle that my friend Julio created, and he had this beautiful talk with them that actually took like 3 hours. And I don't even think the kids knew it took 3 hours. They thought maybe it was maybe half an hour, but they were so into his story. Because here's a Mayan from Guatemala whose whole family was killed by the National Guard there during the 70s. And, you know, when you hear what he's talking about and the pain that he's been through, but the fact that he came to overcome all this and how the indigenous sweat lodge ceremony purified him and allowed him to have a ritual, a community ritual, in which his healing could happen. This is what they were interested in because the kids didn't know, how do we heal? They all been hurt. They all been traumatized. They all had this rage, and they didn't know where do we go. And we began to show them some of the healing ways. And I'll tell you that we created the two sweat lodges, one for the women, one for the men. And one thing I realized, and I'm sure I knew this before, but the women sure got it together when it came to doing these kind of things, because the women's sweat lodge was really nice and round, very well put together, and the men's was kind of a little sloppy and laps, you know, leaning over a little bit. And we realized that what it was is the women were talking to each other and sharing, and therefore that they could do it, whereas the guys just didn't want to talk to each other. And they, you know, but it didn't matter. They got into the sweats that they created. And I saw these gang kids, tattooed gang kids, because you have to go in there with your shorts and a towel and bullet holes. Everything you see now, you can see when they take the shirts off, the tattoos, the bullet holes. And I saw enemies standing next to each other, kind of scared but willing to go through this ritual. And by the very end, nobody was hating each other. By the very end, nobody was raging. And on their own, those one group of kids that had mad dogged the other group, they came to the camp where they were staying and walked all the way over. And first we thought they were going to come over to continue the fighting and whatever. They came over to apologize. And this is a one-day thing. And you're talking about kids who had several generations of gang warfare, people told me these kids will never stop hating, never stop fighting. And in one day, this is how much we got out of them. Well, on their own, they came to apologize to this other group, and then we had another little circle and discussion. And it taught me something that I've been trying to do since then, is that creating community, the ability to have adults, mentors, teachers come together with young people in a respectful, meaningful, and authentic manner. That this is what I think we need to start doing today. And I know it's hard in a society that does not care, in a society that doesn't bring the resources where it needs to be, in a society that's going to war in Iraq and, you know, the schools aren't being taken care of, but we got the biggest military army in the world. But I think that that's exactly precisely the world that this community has to be created in. A community that can actually get conscious of these realities. Be not only conscious, but also able to impact that reality. What we're trying to get young people to see, thank you, is that they have a meaningful life. That what they are and what they've been through is very important. And that they can do something wonderful, beautiful, and meaningful in this world. And most people don't ever tell these kids that. Most of them, by the way, have heard over and over again, because I've asked them, they will never amount to anything. How many heard this? I'm sure, yeah. You will never amount to anything. A lot of young people get that. And I don't know where that comes from. It's one of the worst things that any adult can ever tell a kid. Now, I got it from both my parents and teachers. So I believed it for a long, long time that I would never amount to anything. And the sad thing about it is if you believe it, you won't amount to anything. You will actually carry out what somebody has kind of branded you to be. And I think it's important that people never say that to kids. No matter how troubled they are, no matter how dumb they make mistakes they may make, no matter all these things, they will always be able to do something useful and wonderful with their lives. Whether they do it or not depends on many things, but that's one thing that at least we got to believe in, that they can do this. The young people that we work with, we look at them as depositories of great gifts. We don't treat them as if they're empty vessels that we have to pour knowledge into. You know, the tabla rasa that you have to write the knowledge on them because they're empty. They come into this world born with great gifts, great capacities, great aptitudes. All of them. Whether you're in the poorest Watts or East LA community or you're in the richest, every young kid has this. This capacity to dream, capacity to imagine, capacity to create art, capacity to make something to shape their lives. And I know that in the world that we're in, we diminish that capacity. We pretend it doesn't exist. We put it down, but still it's there. It never dies. And I learned this having gone through my own recovery. I was on drugs for 7 years, and then I drank for 20 years. Having gone through the gang life, having gone through jail, in and out of jails, I learned that even though I thought I didn't have anywhere to go, and the world closes in on you, and you seem there's nowhere, and you're stuck, you start learning that inside of you is this creative power that is inexhaustible, this creative power that can never be wasted. This creative power that when you need it, you can always tap into it. It's always there. And we don't teach ourselves and our children that that's what makes them human beings. To shape their life and the life around them. That they have this power. Instead, we want them to be shaped into what we think they need to be. Productive citizens, right? You all heard this productive citizens thing? I also think it's another thing that should be challenged. Productive for what? When I was going to high school, it was a productive thing for me to end up working in the factories that used to exist all over in and around East LA and South Central. You know, I don't know if I'm sure you're aware of, LA has been one of the largest industrial centers in the world. Huge factories used to be all over LA. Bethlehem Steel, the General Motors plants, the Ford plants, all the tire plants, aerospace. There was so much industry in LA. And I'm sure you're aware of that a lot of these communities like South Central, East LA, Southeast LA, some of the poorest working class communities were created to cater to that industry. and that people came to live there. In the 50s and 60s, there was restrictive covenants. If you came from Mexico, you came from the south, you were poor, you couldn't move anywhere. You moved into those neighborhoods in which those factories became your only outlet. And if you go to those schools, they looked exactly like the factories you were going to end up in. All those schools, manual arts, you know, Jefferson, Jordan High School, Garfield, Roosevelt, they all looked like the schools, like the factories you were all going to end up in. And if you went to your teacher and you constantly you said, maybe I want to take academic courses, they would completely tell you no. You're good with your hands. I heard this over and over again. So we were being geared to work in that industry. But as you know, that industry no longer exists like it used to be. And in the 70s and 80s, those big plants all closed down. Every single one of them. American Bridge, American Can, National Can, National Lead. I used to work in those places. I worked in Bethlehem Steel for 4 years. It closed down in 1981. And when that plant closed down, they created, out of the Union Hall, the largest food bank in the country. 6,000 to 10,000 families a week were being fed there. People don't know about this. I wrote about it in the LA Weekly in a small little piece they allowed me to put in there. But it's not what most people in LA think about. They think about Hollywood, they think about the West Side, they think about beaches. They don't think about how this industrial world has contributed and also shaped what happens in LA. And if you also follow the destruction of the industry, you will find that has also been at the exact same time the greatest rise in gang violence in the history of the United States in that areas. Where that industry went down, the gangs went up. It's true in Chicago, which is the industrial center of the United States. L.A. and Chicago are the two biggest, quote, gang cities in the country. They were also the two most industrial cities in the country, and they also lost more industry than any other cities in the country. There's a direct correlation. And now, because there isn't those kind of jobs anymore, you go to some of these schools, you know what they look like? They don't look like factories anymore. You know what they look like? Prisons. They look exactly like prisons. And not only that, I have been to some elementary schools where they have lockdowns. They're training these kids from when they're young to accept the concept that they should have a lockdown in their life. And if they look like prisons, and if they treat them like they're in prison, that's where they're going to end up. And if you think about it, all this stuff seems like, well, how do people think about this? Who's behind it? Who created this? You know, it's not a simple matter. Of course, it's more complicated than that. But somehow social energy is being pushed around and shifted. And it's directly related to the fact that industry in this country has changed, that technology has come in, but the technology, the way it's being used under the capitalist system right now, cannot really accommodate all those people. So now you're seeing the greatest rise of prison involvement in the history of the country. As you know, we are now the number one nation that imprisons people in the whole world. More than Russia, more than any other country per capita, the United States imprisons more people. And as you know, because I know I'm not telling you something you don't know, vast majority of those people are those people that live in those communities, from those communities that used to have that industry that no longer exists. Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, all the Northeast Coast, Midwest, all over California where industry was set up in the South. Every one of those places is where those plants and those prisons, where those prisons are rising up. In California, we have 160,000 prisoners. It's the largest single state prison system in the United States and therefore in the world. And when I was getting in trouble 30 years ago when I was in and out of jails, there was 13 prisons. Today, there's 32, 33 prisons. That's how fast they're rising up. And as you know, the number of colleges that were created in that same period, two, maybe three, in the state of California, though the prisons have gone up and the colleges and schools have not been catching up to the level of where the prisoners are going. So the reason why then I want to mention all this, because when I wrote Hearts and Hands, I wanted to address these issues, but I wanted to do it in the way that we could really impact them. And it wasn't just going to be one way or superficial way. It was going to have to be very deep. And it was going to touch upon mythological issues, psychological issues, sociological issues, political issues, spiritual issues. Every part of our human being would have to be engaged. Every part of it. I needed to address their intellectual development. I needed to address their psychological development. I needed to address the physical and also spiritual aspects of their lives. We could not leave any one of these things behind, because what happens with young people is they're being fractured. The school will take care of their teaching. If they're psychologically harmed, they go somewhere else to the therapist, if that even exists. If they're on drugs, there's another place to deal with them. If they need spiritual things, they go to church on Sundays. Everything's broke, fractured. You see what I'm saying? And nobody ever puts it together for them. Nobody ever says that this is a whole cohesive community coming to meet your needs. That's what I think we're at. Can we be a cohesive community coming to meet their needs? Because we're not just meeting the needs of young people separate from the fact that our needs aren't being met either as adults. I have learned one thing working with young people. I've become a fuller adult having to spend time with these young people. There's no way that I could be a better adult unless I went and tried to make a better young person. And it works together like that. So that to me is what I'm trying to say with Hearts and Hands. Hearts and Hands, by the way, came from two sources. One is Joseph Campbell, who wrote about hearts and hands that were behind all the great mythological stories, all the great learnings and wisdoms of human beings were starting to come through in the mythology, in the myths, and that each story told lessons and life lessons and lessons about heroism, obstacles, growth, about initiation, these things that we don't talk about anymore, but were vital to human beings in almost all cultures. But the other place it comes from was from the Mexica, or what is known as the Aztec culture. The Mother Earth, one of the names of Mother Earth, one of the names of the deities, which they're not really deities, they're energies, is Cualicu. And one of her statues that they were found in Mexico was, she has a serpent skirt. That's what Cualicu means, serpent skirt. But she also had a necklace of hearts and hands. And really, it was symbolic of what community is. The community that puts the hands on the issues, on the youth, on the problems, on the trouble, and also puts the hearts right there. That's what community is, and that's what we need to establish again here, everywhere where we can, to create those kind of communities. I want to open up to you. I can keep talking, and I know that I don't want to just keep talking, but I hope what I wanted to do was to spark some maybe new ideas or ways of thinking, or maybe some challenges and some questions and maybe some arguments about what we're talking about here. And I want to open it up to you to see what your thinking is and perhaps some of your questions and maybe some of your comments about this, some of these things we're trying to do. Before I do that, I do want to invite you, of course, to get the book. I brought a few copies. I also, with my beautiful wife, Trini, who happens to be here, and a brother-in-law, we created a cultural center in the Sylmar community in the Northeast Valley. And it's very important that I bring this up, because I think what we wanted to establish with the center is not quite just a business or just a center. It's really something else. And anybody that's been there will know the spirit of this place. It's an art gallery. It's a performance space. It's a bookstore. It's a cafe. It's a gathering place. People see show films and they talk about them. People have open mics. They get up and read poetry. They sing. People have dialogues. People dance. There's music. But there's also this intellectual enhancement, this aesthetic enhancement, this culture enhancement. You feel that you're coming to a place where you can grow, where you can become large. And that's what I think is missing in a lot of communities. I'm assuming this is the kind of place it is. Exactly. And I'm glad to see all this beautiful art and all this stuff, because I think that's what we need, more of that, where people really directly have their hands right on this issue, and they create these centers where people get large in themselves. And if they become large in themselves, if they become complete in themselves, all of us become larger and all of us become completer. So anyway, let me open it up to you. Thank you. Anybody else? Anybody got questions? Yeah, right there.
So is your community out there mainly Native American, Latino, or are there other elements, other diverse groups?
Yeah, in the Northeast Valley, it's about 400,000 people, which is a lot of people. That's 80% Mexican, Central American. So we're very much based in that community. Pacoima is one of the biggest, poorest neighborhoods in all of LA County, and it happens to be in the Northeast Valley. It's a very old neighborhood, but we also have a lot of other neighborhoods around there. Some are poorer than others, but they're basically working-class communities. When we got there 3 years ago, my wife grew up in Pacoima, we realized that it was culturally barren. Not that the people were culturally barren, but there was no bookstores, no movie houses. Here we are in the entertainment media capital of the world, and you got whole communities in LA where there's not one movie house. And we thought we needed to create a space where some of this stuff can come together. As soon as we created the space, people came out of the woodwork, as they say. They came out. We had singers. We had dancers. We had poets come out. And plus, it's not just, we're not limited to the Mexican Central American community, though. I mean, that in itself would be great. Everybody's welcome, and we've had all kind of people come and participate. And when they see it, they know exactly how it works, and they know how to enjoy it and engage themselves in it. So we're open to anybody and everybody. It's not just the Mexican or Central American community. But obviously, we also want to make sure that community gets what it needs as far as the cultural and intellectual life that it needs. Oh, okay, I'll repeat the question. The question has to do with the schools and how the kind of overflow that I might have with the schools, interaction with the schools in relation to the center, what I do. And actually, a lot of what I do is in the schools. One thing is that I speak in a lot of schools. I was just in Venice High School about maybe a month ago. I speak to schools all over L.A., my book, I'm sure you're aware of, is one of the most well-read books in the schools. They tell me it's also one of the most stolen books in the schools. And that's because, you know, again, these are communities that don't have bookstores. In Manual Arts, I spoke there. They told me that they had bought 200 copies of my book 1 year, and only 18 came back. But you know what? If you're a student in Manual Arts and you love a book, where are you going to buy it? You almost have to steal it. And so I think that, not that I'm encouraging people to steal, but I think the idea is that if they love something, if they can relate to it, it's there. So I will do that. Plus, by the way, Tia Chuchas, we work with a lot of schools. We have elementary school kids come in there during the day sometimes. We have them come to the center. During the walkouts, Sylmar High School and San Fernando High School had walkouts. What we did, working with the teachers and the students, we invited them to come to Tia Chuchas for a teaching. Yeah. Tia Chuchas Café Cultural. By the way, I don't know if I even said it. It's called Tia Chuchas Café Cultural. And we invited them, and they had like 200 kids come in there. We showed them a film. There was a theater group. We had people dialoguing, and we had a teaching. So that center really intersects with what the young people are going through. Oh, the address is 12737 Glen Oaks Boulevard, number 22. It's in the Pizza Hut Mall, and I do have flyers back there that also has directions. And we have a website, tiachucha.com. Go ahead, in the back. Okay, the question is, what kind of solution would there be considering that industry is leaving, considering that we have more people needing work jobs, but jobs are not there? Well, there's a lot of different solutions, but one of the things that I think that we're showing with Tia Chuchas is one thing is in many ways we have to create our own economies, sustainable economies. We have to be very creative about these economies. We can't wait for the big plants. They're not coming back. You know what I'm saying? General Motors was a big plant in Van Nuys, by the way. In fact, the reason why Pacoima and those communities were created because of places like General Motors, and they all died. So they're not coming back. And the small little businesses that are hiring people are not going to be able to accommodate all those people. So then we're thinking about how do we create our own institutions that aren't just there just to make money for some big corporation, a big franchise, and takes it out of the community, that can really benefit the community and where the money goes to the community and people feel like, you know what, I'm making money, I see where it's coming from, and it's going back to help this community. And I know that might seem a little odd, but I see it happening. With Tia Chuchas, by the way, that's exactly the concept behind it. Everything's going back to the community. Everything's going back. We hire kids from the community. We train people. Hopefully we train them enough so they can start their own institutions, start their own Tia Chuchas or whatever they want to call it, and that we could give that kind of, imagination behind what's happening, because the biggest problem, I think, with the economy is that we've lost the imagination to dream something else. You know what I'm saying? We're stuck with the way that society has given us. This is the social order, and that's it. How do we reimagine other ways of relating and doing things without being exploitative, without being uncompassionate, without being against nature and ecology and all these things that so many corporations are? Okay. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.